Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre, right by Queen Square, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to all in Bristol, and also to our listeners in Preston, and to those all over the world accessing the show on the internet. Our studio guest this week is Michael Doble, chairman of the Thomas Chatterton Society. Chatterton was considered by many to be England's first romantic poet, and one of the finest. We also welcome Lisa Royden from Finland. Lisa is going to tell us about Finland during World War II. Malcolm will be reading some of Chatterton's great poetry. And as ever, Jeff Sparks is here to bring us his weekly What's On and Song of the Week. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Katie Austin.
Before I pass over to Michael Doble, our reporter Anthea Page went over to St. Mary Redcliffe to set the scene. And that will be followed by one of Thomas Chatterton's poems, read by Malcolm Grieve. It's called The Elegy on the Death of Mr. Phillips. And so now, over to St. Mary Redcliffe.
I'm inside St. Mary Redcliffe. The bell ringers have just started off, and one of the staff has just opened the door to the Thomas Chatterton room, and I'm just going to go up this very windy staircase. It's just so weird to think that he trod these very steps I'm going up now. It's a long way up, but I've reached a little doorway here. Oh, I'm in a very small room. There's some boards here. Thomas Chatterton, 1752 to 1770. We're in a very low ceiling room. It's octagonal shaped almost, isn't it? With small windows. So what's the significance of this room then?
It's just like a bit like a museum. And
is this where he actually wrote his poems up here?
Yes, I think that's what the saying goes, yes.
This is called the Chatterton Room. One of the 14th century chests. Is that here? Which he wrote his poems on. Here we are. This is one of the chests he wrote. It's a very big chest, isn't it? With iron strap work.
Yes.
Yeah. In 1753, he was baptised here in St. Mary Redcliffe. This is called the... What's it called? Muniment.
Muniment.
Above the north porch. And where are the medieval manuscripts now? Where are they housed? Have they gone to the British Library or somewhere?
Probably, yes.
Extracts from Elegy to the Memory of Mr. Thomas Phillips of Fairford by Thomas Chatterton. When golden autumn, wreathed in ripened corn, from purple clusters pressed the foamy wine, thy genius did his sallow brows adorn, and made the beauties of the season thine. With rustling sound the yellow foliage flies, and wantons with the wind in rapid whirls. The gurgling rivulet to the valley hies, whilst on its bank the spangled serpent curls. Majestic summer's blooming flowery pride next claimed the honour of his nervous song. He taught the stream in hollow trills to glide, and led the glories of the year along. Pale rugged winter, bending o'er his tread, his grizzled hair bedropped with icy dew, his eyes a dusky light, congealed and dead, his robe a tinge of bright ethereal blue, his train a motleyed, sanguine, sable cloud. He limps along the russet, dreary moor, whilst rising whirlwinds, blasting keen and loud, roll the white surges to the sounding shore. Wet with dew the yellow hawthorns bow, the rustic whistles through the echoing cave, far o'er the lea the breathing cattle low, and the full Avon lifts the darkened wave. To the reader, observe in favour to an hobbling strain. Neat, as exported from the parent brain, are each and every couplet I have penned, but little laboured, and I never mend.
That was Malcolm Grieve reading Elegy on the Death of Mr. Phillips by Thomas Chesterton. And I'd like to welcome to the studio now Michael Doble, chairman of the Thomas Chesterton Society.
Hello.
So tell us a little bit about, for the totally uninitiated, who may well have heard of Shakespeare, and that's about probably about their great knowledge of ancient literature of Britain, who is Thomas Chesterton and why is he significant to Bristol?
Thomas Chesterton was born on the 20th of November in 1752 and lived a very eventful life, which was unfortunately foreshortened to a sum total of 17 years, 277 days. So he lived a very short period indeed. And he's very interesting and important as a poet because he was born in a little cottage right next to St. Mary Redcliffe Church, the church that Queen Elizabeth I called when she visited the fairest and goodliest parish church in all the land.
And this is the little cottage that a lot of people may pass all the time without even noticing when you go towards the Temple Mead station, just on the other side of the road, a very sort of anonymous looking place.
That's right. It's a very drab little grey cottage and not very imposing in any way at all. But it does have some mementos to him, per se, in their little plaques saying that he lived there and was born there in 1752, but nothing that really demonstrates to the world just what a great poet he was.
So what did his contemporaries, some of the great poets and some of the people who came after him, say to give us a taster of in what esteem he was held by some as a poet?
Yes, well, the problem was that he wrote his poems in the guise of a 15th century monk called Thomas Rowley, and when he died, the interest was on whether they were actually written by Thomas Rowley or written by Chatterton. And so it wasn't until the Romanticist movement came after him that the worth of his poetry was really recognised. The immediate critics after his death missed it entirely. So if we look to people like Keats, John Keats, he said of Chatterton that he was the purest writer in the English language. His English was the purest English, and he preferred it to Milton's Cut by Feet. That's his quote. Wordsworth said that his genius was universal and that he excelled in every species of composition. Oscar Wilde said that he was one of England's greatest poets and died at 17 years of age, a mature genius. So the great poets that came after him recognised his true worth.
So presumably one wonders, he can't possibly have got a huge amount done if he only lived to 17. I mean, most people probably even hadn't started to write poetry by then, or only juvenilia.
That's right. Well, he was. There are a number of things about him that he was very, very precocious, and he used to work very, very hard. He would, when he shared a room with someone, the chap he shared the room with said that he never actually saw Thomas Chesterton asleep. Obviously, he did sleep, but he used to work until 1 or 2 in the morning, and then he'd be up again at 4 or 5 in the morning. So the chap didn't actually see him sleeping. And apparently on a full moon, rather like Milton, he would work the full day, 24 hours. So not only was he very hard-working, but he was very precocious and worked very, very rapidly with much less editing of his work than someone like Milton. So as a consequence, his total canon is over 600 pages,
right,
written in approximately something like 18 months. Whereas if you take the work of William Wordsworth, our poet laureate, he wrote something like 950 pages or thereabouts in over 60 years.
I mean, he inspired a lot of people in the Romanticist movement, certainly sort of early 19th century and onwards. And we sort of have images of what those people sort of looked like and what their life was like. So what was his family life like? What was his background in the 1750s?
Yeah, he was from a very modest background, lower middle class, you might say. His father was a school teacher, and his mother, to make ends meet, had a dame school teaching them to sew. But the greatest tragedy, he also had a sister, but the greatest tragedy for Chatterton himself was that his father died before he was born. In fact, 3 months before he was born. So he had a very impoverished upbringing in terms of parental care and parental guidance, particularly from the father, of course. His mother and sister brought him up, but he wasn't they weren't very well educated, and so he essentially taught himself. And disappointingly, he was rejected from his first school when he was a primary pupil at 16 years of age. He was thrown out of the school for being, in quotes, a dullard incapable of improvement. Now, what happened in that school is they mistook his the wandering mind of a romantic genius with someone who couldn't pay attention in school and concentrate on the more mundane things of tuition, such as arithmetic. So he was at home for something like 18 months through his seventh year and part of his eighth year, I believe. And he was inspired by the illuminated capitals of a French music folio. And so this captured his imagination, the graphics of it.
Where did you see this?
It was in his home, and these were folios pilfered from the church by his father.
Okay, from across the road.
Yeah, that's essentially how the Rowley story started. His father took old parchments and folios from the church to use to cover schoolboy books, because he was a school teacher at the same school that Chatterton attended on after his father's death, Pyle Street School, and to cover school books and also to cover Bibles and so on. And this was the first Chatterton saw of heraldry and the Gothics and scripts and so on, the illuminated capitals, and these captured his attention, and he couldn't read or write at that time. But so when he saw them, he pleaded to his mother and his sister to teach him how to read and write, and once they taught him the basics of it, of reading and writing, he taught himself, and he read everything he could lay his hands on. He used to go, with the small amount of pocket money he had, he used to borrow books from the lending library, but also he made friends with a Mr. Green, who was the largest bookseller in Bristol, and he would sit in a corner devouring all the books in the bookshop, but never buying them because he couldn't afford them. But he'd gone very well with this chap, Mr. Green. He liked him. He liked his wit and his cheek for such a young boy. So he let him have a little area in the shop, and he sat in the corner and read to his heart's delight of all sorts of subjects, like I say, heraldry, architecture, history, philosophy, religion.
So
many
he was,
subjects.
He was capable of quite an intense sort of hyper-focus, if you like, quite evidently.
Yes. Very, very hard-wearing, very, very focused. And he had a bit of a scattergun approach. He would devour a subject for so many days or weeks and then jump onto something else, a grasshopper approach. And he kept a little diary of all the books he read. Obviously,
it was actually a record of all of the books that...
Well, he did keep one. I don't think it's existent today.
Okay.
But within a matter of months, he'd read 70 books or something like that.
Right. I mean, so much of life sort of in those times was dominated by the church and religion, obviously. But, I mean, the church was a dominating theme in his mind and all throughout his childhood. What sort of background did he have in the church through his family?
Well, through his family, there was a strong connection with the church because his uncle was a sexton there. And the sextons, through the church, had been a part of the Chatterton family for over 150 years.
Right.
So there's a long history with the church. And his father was a subchanter at the cathedral. So there was a church connection there as well. So, yeah, a significant influence. And hence this... I think he felt alienated from the mercantile world of Bristol in the 18th century, and so he sort of disappeared into his own make-believe world of chivalry and heraldry and brave knights and so on of the 15th century, and the church propagated that direction in his thinking and his creativity because of course the beautiful architecture of the church. It's considered one of the most beautiful Gothic churches in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And the gargoyles and the stained glass with the knights in their shining armour and so on. That's what inspired him. And in particular, there was one particular person within the church who inspired him, and that was William Canning. And William Canning was a great benefactor. He was a merchant, but he was also a great benefactor of the church and had significant rebuilding work done, particularly the roof and so on. So that must have been a great influence on Chatterton. And apparently Thomas Rowley was a friend, per se, of William Canning, and he was from another church, St. John's.
Yes, that's where he got the name from.
Yes, yeah, he existed. Thomas Rowley actually existed, but he wasn't the poet that Chatterton claimed he was.
So, I mean, like a lot of boys, he would sort of create sort of fantasy stories, but in an extremely hyper-focused and sort of very eminently literally advanced way. I mean, tell us a little bit about this character that he created, Thomas Rowley.
Thomas Rowley. Well, not a great deal is known about him. He was most certainly a priest, and if you visit now St. John's Church, which is on the other side of Corn Street from St. Mary Redcliffe Church, you can see a brass of Thomas Rowley and his wife. And interestingly enough, that church was part of the old city wall, and you can see the portcullis grooves on the entrance still to this day. And that was the portcullis that Queen Elizabeth went through when she visited the city and the church. I know for certain that he created a guild in the crypt of St. John's Church. And that's all really that's known about him, not very much at all. And certainly there's no basis to assume that he wrote these poems at all, no.
So, I mean, quite apart from sort of teaching himself to read, I mean, how did he approach the concept of writing from the perspective of a 15th century monk stylistically? I mean, what sort of style was it in?
Yes, well, he created, in a way, his own language. He used dictionaries to get the basis of the type of words used at that time, and he simply added consonants on the end and E's on the end of everything whenever he felt like it. For instance, God would be G, instead of being G-O-D, would be G-O-D-D-E. And not only would he make up words, he changed words, the spelling of them, in the same verse or even in the same line out of convenience and out of aesthetics, visual aesthetics of the design of the stanza. So that in itself made his work difficult to read.
Although it may not have been that unusual, because before Samuel Johnson's dictionary, a lot of people used to... There wasn't really the concept of such a fixed idea of spelling, I suppose.
No, possibly not. But if you read Chaucer, of course, at least you're reading text in the idiom of that time. Right. With Chatterton, you're reading a bit of a hodgepodge that was of his creativity, his imagination.
Okay.
And that's why there was such a controversy as to whether or not the poems were actually written by Rowley, or whether it was Chatterton making them up, or maybe it was a halfway house of Chatterton found some old poems and merely modified them to his own choosing.
So how do these, once he's kind of written this sort of phenomenal body of work, how does it enter the public sort of realm? Where do the first sort of allegations of forgery, and how does this all...
Well, very little was published of his Rowley work in his own life. He, when he left Bristol and went to London, he basically earned a living as a journalist, writing pieces, political pieces, essays, sketches and so on, that would be published in magazines such as Town and Country. Rowley wasn't really... it was his baby when he was in Bristol, but when he went to London, he basically dropped Rowley because he saw that... It wasn't really capital as publishing material in London. The politics of the day was the thing to write about to earn a living as a journalist and do your Rowley in your free time sort of thing. But when he died, that was when the furore all started, because his premature death exposed the work. And... initially, it was seized upon by the critics and the professors of ancient writing and so on as a debate as to whether or not it was written by Rowley or by Chatterton. And no one really looked at the work for the beauty or the brilliance of the poetry itself.
So they didn't really... they kind of focused on the wrong elements of it purely because they couldn't believe that he could have written so.
That's right. That's right. They were much more interested in disseminating it, chopping it up into bits and pieces to say whether or not it was written by a 15th century monk or whether it was.
There's quite a delay in the recognition of his true legacy, especially in terms of how he influenced sort of a lot of the romantic poets that followed. So I think we'll kind of stop there at that sort of tempting point, and then we can carry on with his legacy. leading up to also his so-called suicide, or possibly not, next week. So for now, Michael Doble, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Michael Greaves is going to come in now to read one last poem by Chatterton.
An extract from the excellent Ballad of Charity, attributed to Rowley by Thomas Chatterton. The gathered storm is ripe, the big drops fall, the forswat meadows smeathe and drench the rain. The coming ghastness do the cattle pall, and the full flocks are driving o'er the plain. Dashed from the clouds, the waters flot again. The welkin opes, the yellow levin flies, and the hot fiery smoth in the wide lowings dies. List, now the thunder's rattling climminger sound cheeves slowly on, and then imbolan clangs, shakes the high spire, and lost, dispended, drowned, still on the gallard ear of terror hangs. The winds are up, the lofty elmen swangs, again the levin and the thunder pours, and the full clouds are brass to tennis in stonen showers. The gathered storm is ripe, the big drops fall, the sunburnt meadows smoke and drink the rain. The coming ghastness doth the cattle pall, and the full flocks are driving o'er the plain. Dashed from the clouds, the waters fly again. The welkin opes, the yellow lightning flies, and the hot, fiery steam in the wide flashings dies. List, now the thunder's rattling noisy sound moves slowly on, and then full swollen clangs shakes the high spire, and lost, expended, drowned, still on the frighted ear of terror hangs. The winds are up, the lofty elm tree swings, again the lightning and the thunder pours, and the full clouds are burst at once in stony showers.
Those two stanzas are the storm scene in a beautiful poem called An Excellent Ballad of Charity, which is based on the parable of the Good Samaritan. And those particular stanzas are well known for being an excellent example of beautiful heroic pastoral poetry.
Excellent. Well, the chairman of the Thomas Chatterton Society, Michael Doble, will hear more from next week. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.
BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
And moving swiftly on, as we mentioned last week, Bristol was the venue for an extraordinary conference last weekend. Alternative View 3 showcased challenging speakers from around the world. That includes Cynthia McKinney, a black ex-congresswoman, who doggedly challenged the Pentagon, Donald Rumsfeld and the war on terror at every step before she was deselected. One of the most powerful speakers there was Liberal Dem MP for Lewes in Sussex, Norman Baker. He took a year out from the Lib Dem front bench to research and write a book about the so-called suicide just before the illegal invasion of Iraq of Government Weapons Inspector David Kelly. In it, he proves, he claims, beyond reasonable doubt, that Thames Valley Police failed in their duty, that the government scientist, respected around the world for his peacemaking efforts, was indeed murdered.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction. And I noticed the largest cheer was when Peter Mandelson was mentioned. Unfortunately, I wasn't entirely successful because he's... although he was thrown to the bottom of the Volga with chains wrapped around him, he's now subsequently reappeared. I'm told that one has to try a stake next time. Serious matters, the death of David Kelly and the events of 2003... as you've heard, I gave up a year of my front bench role to look at this matter. And I did so because it seems to me the events of 2003 are of critical importance to this country still in terms of how we are run, how those responsible for government behave, what the morality or otherwise of those in government is, and there is unfinished business from 2003. There's unfinished business in terms of the Iraq War. There's unfinished business in terms of David Kelly's death. We have an opportunity to pursue that now because the Chilcot inquiry is now underway. That's allegedly an independent inquiry to investigate the run-up to the Iraq War, the war itself, the conduct of the war, and the aftermath. I've met Sir John Chilcot, and I've raised with him issues of concern to me, including David Kelly's death. It's unfinished business because what happened in 2003 was a disgrace to this country, an affront to democracy, and cannot be allowed to happen again. Those responsible must be brought to book. Let me run through that in some detail. You may recall in the run-up to the war in 2003, we were told in increasingly strident terms by Tony Blair and Alistair Campbell and others how the threat from Saddam Hussein was increasing, how it was necessary to try to head off these weapons of mass destruction which he had, how the UN had to be engaged in a desperate attempt to avoid war, and how at the last minute it was not possible to avoid war, and very reluctantly we had to go and undertake that overseas expedition. Of course, the truth is entirely different to that. Tony Blair was asked on the 8th of July 2003 by the liaison committee, that's a senior committee of committee chairs in the House of Commons, when it was he decided to go to war. He said, "I decided that we could not avoid conflict in the few days before the vote on 18th of March, because it was then that it was obvious that we could not get a second UN resolution that delivered an ultimatum to Saddam. Up until that point, I was still working to avoid the conflict." So we're led to believe by Tony Blair that he decided only 3 months earlier, or 4 months earlier in March 2003, that that was when war was inevitable. Interestingly, subsequently, there emerged in the Sunday Times a memo written by Matthew Rycroft, the Prime Minister's private secretary, taken in July 2002, which was headed, "This record is extremely sensitive, no further copies should be made," which is doubtless how it got to the Sunday Times. And it reports on the discussions between Sir Richard Dearlove, then the head of MI6, quaintly known as C, and this is what he is recorded as having told Tony Blair and the cabinet, or elements of the cabinet. C reported on his recent talks in Washington, "There was a perceptible shift in attitude. Military action was now seen as inevitable. Bush wanted to remove Saddam through military action, justified by the conjunction of terrorism and WMD. But the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy." July 2002. And what was the response of British ministers to that assessment from the head of MI6 at that point? Was it horror that the Americans are going to break international law? Was it a determination to use our so-called special relationship to rein them in? No, this is what Jack Straw's foreign secretary is recorded as saying in July 2002. "It seemed clear that Bush had made up his mind to take military action, even if the timing was not yet decided. But the case was thin. Saddam was not threatening his neighbours, and his WMD capability was less than that of Libya, North Korea, or Iran. We should work up a plan for an ultimatum for Saddam to allow back in the UN weapons inspectors. This would also help with the legal justification for the use of force." So there's no doubt that ministers had decided in July 2002 to go to war. That's absolutely clear. At the very latest, they may have decided even earlier than that. And what happened after July 2002 and between then and March 2003 was a whole series of dossiers were produced, the famous dodgy dossiers, designed to convince parliamentarians and the public at large that the threat from Saddam was increasing and the military action was to be inevitable. That was a disgraceful deception. When we were told, first of all, that no war had been decided upon, and there had been, and then information was manufactured to justify the case for war. Hans Blix, the UN weapons inspector, subsequently said that the British government had taken the advice from the security services, the intelligence, and had changed question marks into exclamation marks. In other words, they corrupted the system for political ends. Tony Blair, that man again, said to the House of Commons this: there was no attempt at any time by any official or minister or member of No. 10 Downing Street staff to override the intelligence judgments of the Joint Intelligence Committee. That includes the judgment about the so-called 45 minutes. We were 45 minutes from doom, as you may remember, according to the headline in some of the papers. It was a judgment made by the Joint Intelligence Committee and them alone, which is contrary to what Hans Blix subsequently said about the interference. And I'm afraid the evidence is that Hans Blix was correct. Because we now know from the various drafts of the dossiers released that each one became stronger than the last, until the last one, which was finally released, was sufficiently strong to serve its political purpose. There were 16 textual alterations suggested by Alistair Campbell. This is the Prime Minister's press officer, remind you, not an intelligence officer, no access to intelligence data. He was suggesting textual alterations. For example, he suggested that instead of maybe a threat, it should be is a threat, which strikes me as not simply presentational changes, but changes to the whole thrust of the document. When it was quite plain in the initial drafts that London was not threatened directly, the 45 minutes related to battlefield conditions, the explanation that it related to battlefield conditions was removed, thereby allowing the Sun and the Evening Standard to run headlines 45 minutes from doom. Sir Roderick Braithwaite, you may not have heard of him, Sir Roderick Braithwaite was a former chair of the Joint Intelligence Committee. And this is what he wrote in the Financial Times subsequent to the war. A spectre is stalking British television, a frayed and waxy zombie straight from Madame Tussauds. This one, unusually, seems to live and breathe. Perhaps it comes from the Central Intelligence Agency's box of technical tricks, programmed to spout the language of the White House in an artificial English accent. There is another possible explanation. Perhaps what we see on television is the real Tony Blair, the man who believes that he and his friend have the key to the horrifying problems of the Middle East. Mr. Blair's prime responsibility is to defend the interests of his own country. This he has signally failed to do. Stiffened opinions, but often in the wrong, he has manipulated public opinion, sent our soldiers into distant lands for ill-conceived purposes, misused the intelligence agencies to serve his ends, and reduced the Foreign Office to a demoralised cipher because it keeps reminding him of inconvenient facts. He keeps the dog, but barely notices if it barks or not. He prefers to construct his foreign policy out of self-righteous soundbites and expensive foreign travel. And may I remind you, that was the former chair of the Joint Intelligence Committee, the senior body of officials looking at intelligence for the government. Tony Blair has never been held to account for that. He has, in a matter beyond satire, where does Private Eye go now, been appointed, of course, as a Middle East peace envoy. So we then had a Hutton inquiry. The Hutton inquiry was set up following the death of David Kelly, officially to look into the circumstances surrounding the death of David Kelly, to which obviously I'll return in a lot of detail in a moment. But what Lord Hutton did with his inquiry was to spend the time discussing whether or not the BBC was at fault for the situation which has arisen, including David Kelly's death, or whether it was in some way the government. And surprise, surprise, Lord Hutton concluded that the BBC was guilty of everything and the government was guilty of nothing. It was the most disgraceful so-called inquiry, I think, in this country's history. So disgraceful was it that when we had the results published in January 2004, it forced the resignation of Greg Dyke, the Director General of the BBC, Gavin Davis, the Chairman of the BBC, Andrew Gilligan, the reporter who had been involved in the story, and led to that spontaneous demonstration of BBC staff as they walked out of Television Centre and stood there defending Greg Dyke in a manner which reminded me of nothing so much as the Prague Spring of 1968 in Czechoslovakia.
That was Norman Baker MP there, talking about his investigation into the strange death of David Kelly in Bristol last weekend. And the book of the same title is available from all good bookshops, as well as the film of his talk, which is available from www.thealternativeview.co.uk, the alternative view is all one word there, and avtv.info. Next week, Norman Baker talks us through the Hutton inquiry and explains why, even though it led to the sacking of Andrew Gilligan and key bosses at the BBC, it was a total whitewash. Now, here's a chance we don't get every day. If plastic singing Santas are getting you down, you can pop down to the mysterious Freemasons Masonic Hall at the bottom of Park Street. They're only open once a year to the public, and it's a chance to pick up a bargain this time, as well as mingle with, in question, members of the craft. That includes, of course, Bristol's Grand Master himself. You might not know that Europe and the United States have been divided up into Masonic provinces for hundreds of years. The Bristol branch publishes its own provincial yearbook, which contains the names of the Freemasons in all the local lodges, but it's not a book the public, or as the Masons call us, the profane, are allowed to see. Bristol is also one of the Masonic provinces that still refuses to permit women to join. So sorry, if you're female and you want to be a Freemason, you'll have to nip Chipping Sodbury where you can. Tours will be available of both the temples at this open day. It's the highlight of the Bristol Masonic Hall, really. The craft temple for the low-ranking Masons has two pillars topped with balls and a checkerboard carpet. That sounds fun. And the higher-ranking Royal Arch Temple also has two columns, this time with a dome shape on the top. And the carpet in that temple is patterned with the six-pointed Star of David, and on it stand flags of the 12 tribes of Israel. All the temple windows are bricked up in Bristol, so neither have any natural light, and, as the tour guide will tell you, some initiation rites are actually performed in these temples, with just the light from one candle. No wonder some candidates shake like a leaf as they're initiated. After all, many believe it is a religious cult. Anyway, if you want to visit Bristol Freemasons Hall, it's open for guided tours and the annual craft fair all day next Saturday. That's the 28th of November. And it's perilously close to the bottom of Park Street. It's just up from the Council House and the Louisiana.
BCFM 93.2 FM. Your choice, your voice.
Well, I'd now like to welcome to the studio Lisa from Finland. Hello.
Hi.
Hello. How long have you been, you're living in Bristol currently, how long have you been here?
In the UK about 10 years, I lived in London before.
Okay, so how old were you when you left Finland?
18.
18, okay.
Yeah.
So you've got some stories to tell us about World War Two. I mean, what, from your grandfather, I believe, used to tell you stories about them.
Yeah, in the continuation war, my granddad had to go. He was drafted in and must have been quite horrible for my grandmother. Obviously, she stayed behind. And all in all, my granddad was there for about 4 or 5 years.
Right, okay. So, I mean, Finland, for the totally uninitiated, is just next to Russia.
Yeah.
And then it's Sweden and then it's Norway, is that right?
Yeah, that's yeah, right, okay. Yeah.
So whereabouts in Finland are you from, sort of geographically?
I'm from the centre of Finland.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it pretty, I'm imagining sort of bleak forests and nothing much else. What is it
like? Yeah, it's a lot of forests and a lot of lakes. There's like over 600,000 lakes in Finland. So.
Whoa.
And Finland is bigger than the UK geographically, but it's only 5 million of us.
Okay, so how have you found the UK?
I do like it here. I mean, there's a lot of similarities between Finnish people and English people. Like,
yeah.
It's like we're all in Europe, but English people seem to find Europe is kind of them over there.
Yeah,
and Finnish people kind of feel the same way.
Okay.
And also this kind of like, people seem to be very anxious about how other nationalities feel about Jews, you know, and I think Finnish people are the same way.
Okay, so how old were you when your grandfather started to tell you stories about his experiences?
Well, he's actually just told my dad, and my dad's told me, because I think my granddad obviously being of the older generation, because I'm a girl, he wouldn't have told me all the really, really gruesome things, but it's like I'm fairly interested in history, and so I've kind of asked my dad a lot about it, yeah.
Right, okay. I understand you told me earlier he was shot in the head, is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
He lived to tell the tale.
Yeah. he was just in a position with other soldiers, and there was a Russian soldier on the other side, and my granddad just said that he poked his head a little bit too far from behind the rocks he was, and he was shot in the head, yeah. Lost consciousness. Luckily, his mate didn't leave him there, but dragged him to safety, and he survived, but he's never had hair grown on that where the bullet went.
Okay, so he's got a big bald spot. Okay. So what sort of things did he tell you about? What sort of stories did he say?
It's really horrendous stuff. Like, he had to take part in this, like, one of the biggest battles there's ever been in Scandinavia by this big lake. And all the Finnish soldiers were basically in this, like, foresty bit, just waiting for the Russian soldiers to come across the lake. Mm-hmm. And they were sending the Russian soldiers across the lake on rubber boats. So my granddad and the other Finnish soldiers were there in the woods just shooting down boatload after boatload after boatload of men. And it's like, it went on for a day or so. So, I mean, these poor men, I mean, they must have been there just waiting for their turn, seeing what happened to the people before them.
Yeah.
And then just going in. Really horrible. My granddad, like, said they was, you know, he had to do it because otherwise they would have come over and shot the Finnish people, but it was like making hay, but just with people and with guns, you know?
Right.
Mm.
That's pretty bleak. I mean, what was he like as a character? Was it, I don't know, was he warm and friendly, or was he pretty cold and reserved? Or
no, I mean, obviously, it kind of, you know, there's a lot of stuff he doesn't talk about. When it's like the Finnish Independence Day and stuff, he does wear a suit and he wears his medal. He's a decorated war hero. He's got like 4 different medals for bravery and stuff like that. So he does wear them, but he doesn't talk about it. I think he talks about it with the other veterans.
Yeah.
But I just think this is the kind of stuff that probably a lot of kind of young people and that are not interested in it because it's like not so cool and that. But I think if people don't forget about it and just keep in mind how horrible it is, I think there'd be less wars. I think it's important to remember.
If Finland has like a national day, I mean, do you think Britain should have one?
Definitely do. Yeah. Yeah.
That's it, because we all feel sort of a bit guilty and be like, oh yeah, but it's all like empire and Union Jack waving is associated a little bit with the British National Party and sort of negative elements, and we all feel a bit embarrassed about it.
I know, but this is the whole thing. Like, I think you can be patriotic without being racist. There's nothing wrong about being proud of where you're from.
What sort of things did your grandfather earn his medals for?
Well, I hasn't gone too much into it, but I know for a fact that he went, because obviously, just because of the way that the war was fought in Finland, the enemy lines and, you know, your own lines were crisscrossing a lot at the time.
Yeah.
So I know for a fact that one medal he got because he went behind the enemy lines and got one of his mates to safety. So I don't know exactly the full details of the situation, but it must have been fairly
grim. Anything else particularly memorable about his adventures? Any other stories to bring to mind?
Well, there is one. This one instance. This was actually already in the 60s. My granddad was camping in the summer, and like he was asleep in a tent, and apparently someone had tried to break into the tent, and they'd like slashed open the tent with the knife.
Yeah.
And my granddad woke up just to the sound of someone slashing the tent open, and he managed to like scare the person who was trying to rob him, you know, scare him off. So I think that was kind of like
another close encounter.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you very much, Lisa, for coming in, and that was a nice sort of brief insight into it, and thank you for waiting.
Thank you.
you're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Our next feature from Anthea Page is an interview with Sue Holtham from Business and Professional Women UK Limited.
Sue Holtham, I'm club contact for the Business and Professional Women in Bristol.
Can you tell us a bit more about your organisation?
It's an organisation that's been going since 1938, so we're pretty much in the long term. And we've got a very simple aim. It's about helping women to develop their potential in all aspects of their lives. And it's the only organisation I've ever come across that deals with me as a person, not as a wife, not as an employee, not as a daughter. It deals with me as a woman, and it's given me so much in the 16 years that I've belonged to it that I really feel as if I owe a lot of my success, both in a work context and also in a personal context, to business and professional women.
How did you come to join this organisation? Because you were a high flyer in the bank, I believe.
That's right. But when I joined, I wasn't. So I found that I wasn't getting the development that I wanted in the work context. I was a manager of a small team, but everyone seemed to regard me as if I was a secretary or someone that they could ask for a bit of direction or a help where somebody was. And I realised I wasn't projecting the right image. So I decided I'd join an organisation outside of work. So not linked in with any banking, but something that was an organisation that was much more diverse. And I found details in a book about what women really want. And I contacted what was then the Cheltenham area and went along to some of their events. But I never actually joined until I was in Birmingham. And then I helped to found a club in Birmingham back in the 1990s. And it was great because it was an organisation that I felt I could make a contribution to, but I had exposure to women who were high flyers, who had their own companies, who ran a charity, who were ladies who lunched, and also ladies who were high profile in their careers. But it was a multiple career position. It wasn't just banking. So I got a lot from just interacting with these other women.
You were talking about women reaching their potential. Could you just give us an example?
When I first joined, I went to the National Conference, which at that time was held in Leeds. And I'd never spoken in front of a group of women before, or a group of anybody before. And I went to the platform to give my thanks to the organisers of the organisation, because it was an event where I just had that goose pimple where you felt as if you were completely empowered to make a difference in a woman's world. And I wanted to go up and express that to the audience. And I stood up there with 500 people all looking at me, and it's true, your knees do buckle when you're faced with 500 people. And I realised then, if I could do that in a BPW context, I could do that in work. So over a period of time, my confidence was gained. I managed to specialise in a particular area within the bank, and I ended up presenting at various conferences, Paris, Amsterdam, London, to an audience of over 1,000 people. And my knees didn't buckle because I knew I could do it. And I think that was down to that very first time with BPW in Leeds.
Can you tell us a bit about the Young People's Public Speaking event that's coming up?
Business and professional women believe in helping young people, men and women, to enhance their speaking capabilities. So we run a national competition with the English Speaking Board. And what we do is we hold a heat at the Bristol level, a heat at the southern regional level, and then they go on to the national competition. And we've had some success with the Queen Elizabeth Hospital School winning our heat for the last couple of years. And we'll be holding that in February. And organisations, youth organisations, are invited to come and give a team of three people. One is a chairman, one is a speaker, and one is an expression of thanks. And they hold a meeting at a venue, and they are given feedback by a set of judges who then they then succeed at Bristol heat level and then move on to the regional heat and compete with teams from Brighton and people from southern Wales, down in Bodmin, Cornwall, etc. So they then pass that and then go on to the National Heat, which is held up at Oswestry.
So are most of the schools in Bristol involved in this event?
We certainly invite them, but we don't get as many as we'd like along to it. So the invitations will be going out to the state schools, the public schools and other youth organisations, you know, Girl Guides, Scouts, and it'll be going out in the next month or so to invite them to come along and participate. There's no charge, it's a free evening, but they just put forward a team and then obviously go through the other heats.
So how many schools roughly engage in this event?
Last year we had 4 schools.
Is that all?
Yes, we would like to have a few more, bearing in mind that we have to run it in an evening. So if we had 20 schools competing, we might have to rethink and run a number of heats. But at the moment, we just had 4 schools last year.
That seems very poor. How many schools do you contact?
We usually contact between 12 and 15.
Could you tell us how schools could contact you if they're listening to this broadcast?
Yes, there's a BPW Bristol website which gives information about the organisation and also what BPW Bristol does. And that's www.bpwbristol.com. .co.uk, and there is a contacts page there which has my personal details, Sue Holtham, and the other members of the committee on it as well, and they're very welcome to send us an email or give us a ring and we can take it from there.
To sum up, your organisation is about giving people confidence in themselves to go forward, is that right?
Yes, it is about giving them the confidence to develop their potential. And whether that's in a work context or whether that's in a personal context, that's about giving something back. We're run by volunteers, it's not a paid organisation, it's not a profit-making organisation. So it is about women who want to help other women develop their capabilities.
Well, that was our Anthea Page doing her reporting duties, talking to Sue Holtham from Business and Professional Women UK Limited. Well, I've got a couple of young ladies sat here who would like to introduce a sort of little advertising piece. I want to plug a bit of classical music that's going on soon, a bit of trumpet playing. So, what are your names?
My name is Izzy Miller.
And I'm Pels.
So, who is playing what?
Well, it's next Thursday, and my brother, Rob Miller, is playing the Gregson Trumpet Concerto. He's playing it with the Glenicles Orchestra, which is a university-run medical... They're all medical students in the orchestra.
OK.
And they've organised it all between themselves, and it should be a very exciting concert. There's the Gregson Trumpet Concerto and Tchaikovsky Serenade for Strings.
OK. So how big is the orchestra?
Oh, I think there must be about... 30,
Yeah, I mean, it's not like a huge symphony orchestra, and there's not quite so many of us, but,
It's quite a new, like, lively group of people who all love music, basically.
Brilliant. And this is at St George's Hall?
That's
St George's
Hall, yes. Yeah.
Okay, and what's the date?
The 26th of November.
26th of November. Okay, how can people get tickets and find out more?
Okay, tickets are £4 and you can get them from St George's, and you can get them on the door.
Yeah.
And it's free for students. More information you could find on the St George's website, advertised under lunchtime concerts.
And there'll be a retiring collection as well for the Teddy Bear Hospital, which is a charity run by the medical students, and it aims to educate children, primary school children, about healthy eating and other health issues, but also gets them sort of used to the health setting environment and not so scared of the doctor.
So there's a contribution towards that as well.
Yep.
Brilliant. Yeah. All right, well, thank you very much for coming in, and that's on the 26th of November.
Yes, at lunchtime in St George's.
At lunchtime. Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks very much.
Well, Jess Sparks is here as ever with the latest in What's On in Bristol, and also the Song of the Week in fine form, wearing a Sepultura T-shirt. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, John. Good evening. This is a What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday, 26th of November, Sham 69 will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance and £12 on the door. Moving on to Friday, 27th of November, the Vibrators will be performing at the Prom Bar in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. Also on 27th of November, the Imperials will be performing at the Fleece in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £7 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I feature the Sick Livers. This group hail from South Wales, and 2 weeks ago I saw them at Area 81 in Bristol, and I was impressed. This is from their recent 3-track CD single, and is the track Hell of a Girl. was The Sick Livers with Hell of a Girl from their recent CD single. For more information on them, you can check out myspace.com/thesicklivers. Into Saturday, 28th of November, the Rolling Zones will be performing at Riff's Bar, which is at 26 Greatfield in Swindon. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and tickets are £6 each. On to Sunday, 29th of November, Parma International will be performing at the Thecla in Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. Finally, on Monday, 30th of November, Dio will be performing with support from Black Spiders at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £20 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, the studio guests this week were Michael Doble, the chairman of the Thomas Chatterton Society, and Lisa Royden, all the way from Finland. And, of course, the two girls who are advertising the Gregson's Trumpet Concerto at lunchtime in St George's Hall on the 26th of November. Malcolm Greaves read a collection of poems by Chatterton in his excellent honey-toned voice, and the features were by Anthony Page and Tony Gosling, and a reminder of that book title, The Strange Death of Dr. David Kelly. If you stick that in Google, I'm sure you'll find it straight away. The studio engineer was Johnny Royden, and the Watson was by Jeff Sparks, and the producer was Anthony Page. It's goodbye from me, John Peters Coleman, and also Katie Austin, presenters of this week's Stylex Radio, and of course there'll be another one next week, so stay tuned, eagerly listeners, for more, and enjoy the autumn.